I'm going to read the first four verses of Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's read God's word together. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, one of my brothers, Hanani, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them about the Jews that survived, those who had escaped the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They replied, "The survivors there in the province who escaped captivity are in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been destroyed by fire." When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Thank you so much. When I was growing up, it seemed like every summer our church had a revival. They would last a minimum of 1 week, but oftentimes they would go 2 weeks, occasionally 3 weeks. And that included two services on Sunday, and then every night during the week except Saturday night. The evangelist conducting the revival usually sang as well as preached. And then for weeks prior to the revival, the pastor would be encouraging us, invite people to come to the revival. I really never understood the purposes of the revival meetings. By the time they were over, everyone was exhausted from going to church. Attendance at the church did not change. And within a few weeks, we were back to our same normal summer routine. All those nights I could have been home watching television that I missed because we were in revival services. You know, that's a little confusing if you look at the definition of the word revival. This is how Webster defined it. The state of being revived, such as renewed attention to or interest in something. Now, over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at the book of Nehemiah. In the book of Nehemiah, we see, a true, accurate picture of what revival looks like, what precedes revival, what occurs during revival, what to be aware of during revival, and what things should look like after revival. We need to remember that Nehemiah was not an evangelist. He was the cupbearer for the king of Persia, Artaxerxes. He's a trusted government official in charge of making sure that the king has an ample supply of wine and that that wine has not been poisoned. And yet God plucks this man out of Susa, which today would be in modern-day Iran, moves him hundreds of miles away to go to the city of Jerusalem, with one particular task in mind, rebuild the walls of the city. And while Nehemiah is there, he is going to face opposition, he's going to face oppression, he's going to face false accusations, he is going to not only have to deal with the walls of the city, he's going to have to deal with the walls of the hearts of the people. And yet we're going to see that because of Nehemiah's obedience to God, the people in Judah, particularly those in Jerusalem, experience a true, life-changing, destiny-changing revival. Let me give you just a brief history. And I almost laughed out loud this morning during Sunday school because Kelly Dixon, who is doing a great job in the book of Revelation, started talking about the book of Zechariah and how the prophet Zechariah was urging the people to, and Zerubbabel, to finish the rebuilding of the temple. And it's all in that same time period of the first captives being sent back and then a second group, and each of them had a specific assignment, and each of them went through the same situation. They grew tired. And they stopped. And God sent somebody to them to stir up their hearts again to finish what God had called them to do. If you want to read about what happened to the city of Jerusalem in 587 BC when the Babylonians came, broke down the walls, burned everything. You can read of it in 2 Kings chapters 24 and 25. The prophet Ezra had prophesied that they would be in captivity for 70 years. And at the end of that 70-year period, a new king and a new kingdom. The Babylonians have now been conquered by the Medes and the Persians. And Cyrus, who's the king, begins to let the Jews go back to their people. The temple is the first assignment. And that is partially rebuilt and then finally finished. The people build their homes, but the one area in which they fail to complete is rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah, when he hears this, is just heartbroken because he realizes it doesn't matter what you've built inside the city if you have not built walls around the city to protect you from your enemies. Everything that you have built inside that city is now vulnerable to attack. I find it interesting what Nehemiah did not do. The first thing he did not do is he did not express his regret over the circumstances in Jerusalem and then forget about it. He was not apathetic. I read this week where someone was asked, what's the difference in ignorance and apathy? And ignorance is, I don't know. Apathy is, I don't care. He refused to be apathetic about what was going on. And if you think about what was going on in Nehemiah's life, you could see how it would be so easy for him to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't have time to deal with that. He was a busy man. He was in a high government position. He served the king. He was entrusted with the king's life. He could have said, I'm too busy. I don't have time. I can't leave my job and leave what I'm doing to travel hundreds of miles to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. He could have also said, you know what? It's not my problem. I'm here. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. That's not my problem. I don't want to get involved in that. He also could have said, you know, you just can't help some people. Some people, it doesn't matter what you tell them, how many times you caution them, how many times you warn them, how many times you try to encourage them, to boost them up. They're just not going to get up. They're stuck, they're in the rut, and you're not going to get them out of the rut. And of course, it would have been very easy for Nehemiah to ask the question, how much will it cost me? What's it going to cost me? What's it going to cost me in time? What's it going to cost me in energy? What's it going to cost me in relationships? Who knows? Maybe Nehemiah was married, had a family. How long am I going to be separated from my family? What's it going to cost me financially? How am I going to afford to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem? Where am I going to get the money for that? Where am I going to get the supplies for that? Where am I going to get all this going to require? It's just too big a cost. You know, Jesus referred to the sin of apathy. In Matthew chapter 25, beginning in verse 42, Jesus said this, I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison and you did not look after me. It's so easy to just see the problem, see the situation, and immediately judge that's going to cost too much. That is too intense. That's too extensive. I'm sorry. Somebody else will have to take care of that. I got enough problems right here of my own to take care of. And to turn our back away from that. And the second thing that it would have been easy for Nehemiah to do, it would have been very easy for Nehemiah to automatically go into action mode. When I was about 8 years old, my parents, for Christmas, now you have to remember, there's nobody living in our house except me and my parents. There aren't, where we're living, there's not even any kids my age. And so it was very difficult to buy me things for Christmas. I played Monopoly by myself. I always won. That was the good thing. But it was hard to get me a football because there was nobody to throw it to. One year they got me an electric race car track. And it was the Circle 8. And it was in the basement of our house. And when Sis and Marvin would come over, Marvin would come downstairs and we'd race cars together. And one of the things I learned is when you're behind in a race car set, you want to go faster. And oftentimes in going faster, as you come into a curve, your car leaves the tracks and goes airborne. It would have been very easy for Nehemiah to have gone into racetrack mode. I've got to do something. It's got to be done now. We don't have time to wait. We've already wasted too much time. It would have been easy for Nehemiah to say, those are my people, and that my brother just came back from there. I've got to do something. What am I going to do? How am I going to get this about? Let me get on the phone and start calling people and find out, can you help me? Will you make a donation? Can I count on you for lumber? Can I count on you for nails? Can I get any concrete that's not going to Amazon? Can I find any building supplies? Somebody needs to do something. And of course, if Nehemiah would have been a Methodist, he would have said, we need to form a committee. We need to form the Rebuilding the Walls Committee. We've got to do something. So easy for us. If we don't forget, we take the opposite mode, and that is we just forge ahead. We put our head down like a linebacker, and we're just going forward. We're going to make something happen. I'm going to do it. You can count on me. It may kill me, but I'm going to do it. And I'm going to worry people and aggravate people and turn people off and make people avoid me because I'm going to keep hounding them because I want them to help me do it. But I love what Nehemiah did. He waited. The psalmist said this in Psalm 24, verse 14. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. We get to that part, be strong and take heart, and we think it means be strong and take heart and do something. But the psalmist said, be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. In Psalm 62:5, we read this, yes, my soul finds rest in God. My hope comes from Him. Why did Nehemiah wait? I think Nehemiah waited because he wanted to make sure that his actions were motivated by his heart, not by his abilities. He wanted to make sure that this was not just something, I'm going to do it because it needs to be done, and I'm just going to press through and I'm going to push through. He wanted to make sure that this is coming from my heart. Listen to what verse 4 said. When I heard these words, I sat down. I wept. I mourned for days. I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. You see, I think Nehemiah believed it was important for him to wait because he wanted to make sure that what he did was not necessarily what he wanted to do, but what God wanted to do. It's been very easy for Nehemiah to jump on a horse, form a little caravan, travel to Jerusalem, get out a measuring tape, start measuring off. How much money do we have? How many supplies do we have? Well, we'd like to build a temple that is 80 by 80, just like the other temple. Whatever, I can't remember the measurements. Kelly, I'm sure, will correct me after church. But we can't afford that. We can only do 10 by 10. But we can do a 10 by 10 temple. Well, let's measure out a 10 by 10 temple. We can only do walls that are 4 feet high. They need to be 20 feet high, but we can only do 4 feet. Well, let's do walls that are 4 feet high. It's very easy for us to conform things to what we have on hand and what we want to see done and what our abilities are and what our capabilities are. And in doing so, we just sort of push God to the side and we say to God, "We'll do it if you'll just bless it when we're done." But Nehemiah waited. What's God saying? What's God doing? What's God want? What's God's desire? What's God's heart? How is God going to put this together so Nehemiah doesn't get the praise or the glory or the accolades, so that Nehemiah can say, "This had to be God"? I heard someone say something, and I agree, and I hope I can quote it correctly. It was this: if what you're trying to do is not so big that it will require God to do it, what you're trying to do is too small. Nehemiah was determined, "I will not factor God out of the equation. I will not factor God out of this so that I can look at it and say, well, this is what we've got and this is what we'll have to do." Nehemiah waited. In fact, some church historians tell us that Nehemiah waited for 4 months. He waited. He fasted. He prayed. He sought God. He wanted to hear the mind of Christ. "God, what do you want to do? What do you want to accomplish? How are you going to bring this about?" It's not easy to wait, is it? I don't like waiting. Friday, I had to stop by Publix to pick up 2 bags of frozen, steamed, creamed spinach. Fortunately, it was buy one, get one free. I pick up my 2 bags of spinach, as Sherry had instructed me to do, and I go to the counter that said 10 items or less. There was a woman. And I'm counting her items as she's placing them on the conveyor belt. We passed 10. We passed 20. We got to 24 items. And I'm saying, "Devil, get out of that woman. Help her to be able to read again." And then I start saying, "Lord, just please don't let her write a check." Because I don't like to wait. I'm sure Nehemiah chafed at waiting and seeking God and trying to hear God's answer. "God, what do you want?" I don't know about you, but I've grown tired of waiting over the situation the United Methodist Church is in. It's very easy to just make a decision. We're going to do this. But God calls us to wait, to see what God may do, to see what God can do, to watch God do things that we don't have the capability to do. In the early 1900s, there were a group of missionaries in Europe, particularly in Germany, Sweden, who were called one-way ticket missionaries. Before they would go on the mission field, they would build their coffins. They would put their material belongings in that coffin. They would buy their passage on a ship, and they would go to the mission field, knowing that it was very likely they would die on the mission field and never come home. One of those missionaries was a Scottish man. His name was Paul Milne, and he felt called to the New Hebrides Islands off the coast of Australia. He was aware that the missionaries who had gone before him had all been killed by the headhunters who lived in those islands. But he couldn't get away from that call of God. And so finally, he built his coffin. He packed his belongings, he and his wife, and they went there. His wife died of illness while they were there. But Paul Milne spent more than 50 years of his life among those headhunters, teaching them about Jesus, translating books of the New Testament into their native tongue so that they would have portions of Scripture. He died of natural causes. And after he was buried, the tribesmen put a tombstone over his burial site with these words: "When he came, there was no light. When he left, there was no darkness." Nehemiah, this government official, minding his own business in the nation of Iran, hears about something that has happened hundreds of miles away. And rather than say, "Well, that's not my problem, I'm not going to do anything about it," and rather than saying, "I've got to do something and I have to do it now, he chose to wait and to see what God would do. He chose to put his trust in God. Maybe there's something burning in your heart today. Maybe there's someone burning in your heart today. Maybe there's some situation that you feel like, "Man, in 5 minutes I could fix that." And God is asking you, wait. Don't just sit. Nehemiah prayed. He wept. He mourned. He fasted. But there's a situation, someone, possibly that God is laying on your heart, and you're frustrated because you want to do something and you don't know what to do. Well, the good news is this: if God put it on your heart, God will make a way. And God will give you the wisdom you need, the strategies you need, the provisions you need, the opening of the door that you need. God will make a way. Will you join me in prayer? Father, as we look around our nation, as we look around our world, as we look around our families, as we look around our own lives, we see so many needs, so many hurting people, so many impossible situations, so many places, so many people that we don't know what to do. But I pray, Father, that we would follow the example of Nehemiah, that we would not just be apathetic and just turn our back and say, "Well, out of sight, out of mind," nor will we rush with no plan and no provision, but try to do something just because something needs to be done. But Lord, that we'll learn to wait, to open our hearts to You, to lift our voices to You, to cry out to You, to see what You might do. Father, I pray that we would keep our eyes upon You. In the name of Your Son, Jesus. Let's stand together today. Will you join me in singing the little chorus as you stand? Turn your eyes.